This is the good life. And my question again to you, are you living the good life? Are you thriving right now, or are you surviving? It's interesting, as these weeks go on and as we live with this reality called COVID, I mentioned that at our annual business meeting, it's like a fog, you know, that we were hitting into a fog, driving on the highway, and all of a sudden, boom, you just hit this fog bank, and all of a sudden, we have to live with a new reality. And so as I'm reading on the internet and articles that are sent and unsolicited and solicited and anything that's coming, I'm just amazed about the spectrum of responses, especially among the Christian community. It's interesting, you know, where you all land on this, you know, from be very antagonistic against everything that the government does, to where I think we should stand as Christians and do what we're called to do is make more and better Christ followers. That's our job. It hasn't stopped when we started wearing masks. It is still on that we need to do this, that we are called to go out into this world and make more and better Christ followers and reaching people with the good news of Jesus Christ and live the good life. The good life, as it is portrayed in Psalm 23 that we are looking at over the last 6 weeks, are not just pretty words. And sometimes we treat the Bible as pretty words that somebody wrote up there who lived in cloud nine and had everything they needed, and they wrote about the good life of a good shepherd, and they could talk about that we have everything we need. This good life is available to every single person here in this room and those who are watching. Do you believe that? That you can live a good life, a thriving life in the midst of COVID, in the midst of all the restrictions, in the midst of things that you may be going through, in the midst of tragedies, in the midst of challenges, in the midst of things that you are facing. Can you believe that the words of David and the Bible are true? Let's read the psalm again together and just let it sink into our hearts and into our minds. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right path for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, and my cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord. Do we live in those realities? I think over the last several weeks, one thing should have become clear. It is not something that we're given to us as a neat package, and we just have to open it and we have it. The good life is something that we need to work on. It is a growing experience that we grow more and more into the more we understand the principles of the life that God is offering us in his kingdom. We often act as if sometimes when we read a good book or we hear a good sermon, that touches us, that hits us, and when we feel like, yeah, that is exactly what I needed, that we often think, now we've got it. We finally have it. And we walk home just to find out that we don't. Because the reality is, and the truth is hitting our brain, it's hitting our mind, it's hitting our thinking, and there's still a long way between brain and heart and my life to live in these realities. I have to admit, this sermon series has been on my file for several years. It was based on a book, by the way, if you want to dive into more, it's based on a book by Dallas Willard. It says, Life Without Lack. And it's like this, when I read this book, it was one of those things when I felt like totally convicted. I said, wow, this is such a good thing. And you're tempted to go out and say, hey, let's share this right away. But I'm in the ministry long enough and in my life with God lived long enough that I know this is a dangerous path to follow. When you just get something, you're excited, and you just need to share that, and you need to all do this, and we all need to do this without me, haven't even started living in those realities. And as I've mentioned at the beginning of this sermon series, I lived with this psalm now for several years, trying to better understand the realities of this psalm, the truth of it, and how it's related, and I would say the more I dive into, the more I know how little I understand, how little I grasp, how little I live with this reality. And I don't want you to go home and feel beaten down and feel like, oh, I'm not getting it. He's talking about stuff that is way beyond what I can do. No, I want you to hear that these are realities that we have to learn. And that takes time, effort, practice. And as we talk about these things and mention several one over the last several weeks, just don't forget this. Those are steps that are so vital in our journey to live this kind of life and to live into this kind of life that is described in this psalm. Here's a triangle that you can see the graphic here behind me. That would explain a little bit, you know, how this life works and is accessible. We talked about it, don't forget this, at the very beginning about mindfulness, you know, the role of our mind, what we feed our mind with, so important. But in the last weeks, we talked about the very essential parts of my own journey as a follower of Jesus Christ, things that need to grow in me and that I need to grow into in order to get into this kind of life of goodness, life of the good life that God provides. We talked about faith, the role of faith, and faith in form of trust. And that's also, by the way how to understand this psalm when it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. It has nothing to do with that I have all my wishes fulfilled. All the toys in my garage and all the money on the bank. And then I say, oh, the Lord is my shepherd. I have all that I need. Has nothing to do with this. But it has a lot to do with the fact that I said, God, if you are my shepherd, Yahweh, the God who is the I am, the great I am, if you are with me, I have all that I need. I don't need anything. And the wish is that at our life of faith, as we grow in our faith and trust, that we learn to get to know God as such a God who is worthy of our trust. The God who is worthy of our entirely reliance on Him. But as we do that, as we learn to trust Him, we also need to learn to deny ourselves. There is this thing which we called self, which is coming up and has all the wishes, all the desires. And we have talked about how the enemy is working on this hard to get us do what we want to do and to tempt us to do what we need to do according to him, and that we come out of that trust relationship with Christ. Remember, the temptations that Jesus had to endure are the same ones that we're facing living outside of the realm of God's care and take care of ourselves. So this self has to die. The self has to die. And the word that the Bible uses is self-denial. Jesus says himself, if you want to come and follow me, you have to deny yourself and come and follow me. It's not about that the self, that we have to give up the self. We all have a self. And the self is created by God. But it is not the king. It is not a good leader. We need to submit ourselves to God, the leader, and say, hey, here are my wishes, God. Here are my desires. I surrender them to you. I submit them to you. That all my desires are in God, that he knows about them. He knows what I need. If you want to read about this, read Matthew 6. And the last part of the chapter, I think it was 20-something, 23. When he talks about the birds in the sky and the flowers in the field and how they all are under God's supervision and God's care. And he says to you and me, are you not much more than these? I care for you. And then he said, seek the kingdom of God first, and it will all be given to you. In other words, he says, you know, your worry should not be what you eat and drink. And remember, he doesn't say this to people who have the fridge full and have the bank account filled. He talks to people in his environment in those days who could not or would not know where the bread and food comes from for the next day. There were no fridges, there were no freezers. There were none of that, and they had to live from day to day. And he says to them, don't worry, because the king will care for you. Trust and put your trust in the kingdom of God, and he will fill and care for your needs. See, and out of that life flows true love. That's what we talk about today, love. It's such a stretched word, has so many meanings, and we can only scratch the surface again this morning, but it's so important. Because a good life is a life of love. And I agree with me, if not now, hopefully by the end, and say that is true. But love only thrives. I mean, the love that the Bible describes as love, it's not the love that we, I mean, Did you recognize Winston there? You know, Winston, who is Niels, who is one of our communicators in the kids' wing. How he talked about, well, you go to Webster, you know, you cannot find the true translation or true definition of love. And he's right. You know, you look into the Bible and see what the love is all about. But love, agape love, is a selfless love, meaning an unconditional love, a love that is not attached to self-interest. How much of what we call love today is intimately connected with self-interest? You know, I love cheesecake. So in that case, I love cheesecakes. Me, I want to have it and eat it. That's not agape love. Because that's selfish. This kind of selfish love is also often in our relationships. I want you, I love you because I want you for me. To fulfill my needs, my desires, my urges. That's why I love you. It's only possible if we live in this pathway of self-denial, when our self is properly put under the reign of our God and say, God, here it is. I want to serve you. You are my God, and I know you take care of me. Now I can love without self-interest, without ideas of, oh, how can I benefit out of that one? What I can get I out of that relationship? But I can say, God, I just love. This is infinite love, or infinite love, but also love that is not under any conditions, unconditional love. That is the kind of life that God wants us to live. The people and persons who are people of love. And that's what we want to explore this morning. There is a vision, and today I just want to do what I would do at the beginning is just read to you some Bible texts. Just follow, just listen. Where the Bible and different writers of the Bible cast a vision for a life that is lived, influenced by this kind of love in practice in our relationships with people. So just listen. The first is Jesus. He talks about this in Luke 6, 27 through 38. He said, "But this is my word," Jesus continued, "for those of you who are listening, love your enemies. Do good to people who hate you. Bless people who curse you. Pray for people who treat you badly. If someone hits you on the cheek, offer him the other one. If someone takes away your coat, don't stop him taking your shirt. Give to everyone who asks you, and don't ask for things back when people have taken them. Whatever you want people to do to you, do that to them. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Think about it. Even sinners love people who love them. Or again, if you do good only to people who do good to you, what credit is this to you? Sinners do that too. If you lend only to people who you expect to get things back from, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get paid back. No, love your enemies. Do good and lend without expecting any in return. Your reward will be great. You will be children of the highest. He is generous, you see, to the stingy and wicked. You must be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Don't judge, and you won't be judged. Don't condemn, and you won't be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good helping, squashed down, shaken in, and overflowing. That's what will land in your lap. Yes, the ration you give to others is the ration you'll get back for yourself. Pretty words? John 13, 31, 35. When Judas had gone out, and I think who Judas was who betrayed him, Jesus began to speak. "Now the Son of Man is glorified," he said. "Now God is glorified in him. And if God is glorified in him, God will glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. Children, I am only with you a little longer. You will look for me. And as I said to the Judeans that where I was going, they couldn't come. So I'm saying the same to you. I am giving now to you a new command, a new commandment. It is this: love one another. Just as I have loved you, so you must love one another. This is how everybody will know that you are, if you have love." Paul to the Roman church, Romans 12, 9 to 10. Love must be real. Hate what is evil. Stick fast to what is good. Be truly affectionate in showing love for one another. Compete with each other in giving mutual. Romans 13, 8 to 10. Don't owe anything to anyone except the debt of mutual love. If you love your neighbor, you see you have fulfilled the law. Commandments like don't commit adultery, don't kill, don't steal, don't covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this: love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to its neighbor, so love is a fulfillment of the law. And here's John, if you will, the favorite disciple of Jesus. Later on, when he was about 90 years old, looking back onto a life of love that he experienced with Jesus, his master, he says in 1 John 11 and following, "Beloved, if that's how God loved us, we ought to love one another in the same way. Nobody has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us and his love is completed in us. That is how we know that we abide in him and he in us, because he has given us a portion of his Spirit. And we have seen and bear witness that the Father sent the Son to be the world's Savior. Anyone who confesses that Jesus is God's Son, God abides in them and they abide in God. And we have known and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love. Those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. This is what makes love complete for us, so that we may have boldness and confidence in the day of judgment, because just as he is, so we are in this world. There is no fear in love. Complete love drives out fear. Fear has to do with punishment. And anyone who is afraid is not completed in love. We love because he first loved us. If someone says, "I love God," but hates their brother and sister, that person is a liar. Someone who doesn't love a brother or sister whom they have seen, how can they love God whom they haven't seen? This is the commandment we have from him. Anyone who loves God. And finally, Paul, one more time, who must have thought a lot about love, because it reappears in his letters. 1 Corinthians, we have heard some of that already. Love's great-hearted. Love is kind. Knows no jealousy, makes no fuss, is not puffed up, no shameless ways, doesn't force its rightful claim, doesn't rage or bear a grudge, doesn't cheer at others' harm, rejoices rather in the truth. Love bears all things. Believe. Here are just Bible texts. And my question to you is, would you think that anyone who lives this kind of love is the highest ethical value that God puts out in his word, love. So let's look briefly into what that means. First of all, we need to say that love, then, is not an action, but the source of action. We tend to measure love in actions, and nothing wrong with that in itself. You know, when we talk, we want to love someone when we talk about things that we do. And again, this is not wrong, but we can also do good things without loving someone. Would you agree? I can do good things to a neighbor and to a friend without loving them. So that is not what love is really all about. Our aim is not to do loving things. Our aim is to become a loving person. Our aim is not to do loving things, but our aim is to become a loving person. And the loving person will do loving things. So we have to work on our heart, on my inner attitude, whatever, wherever that is located. That has to become loving. It's not so much about the acts of love. We can do a lot of acts of love that look like that, but are not there with our heart. Even if we love an enemy, Jesus says, you know, love your enemy. It is not about that we should come to an enemy and just do good things to an enemy. That's okay. But we come to an enemy as a loving person. Would that make a difference? I come to an enemy as a loving person. So that animosity that is against me doesn't change me, because I'm a loving person. I'm loving people. And therefore, if we also read and have read and followed along very carefully with the text, 1 Corinthians 13 is not actually something that we should strive for. Did you notice that? It is a description of a loving person. Love is kind. It doesn't say, and you should be that. No, love is kind. If you have love, then it's kind. If you have love, then you will not count, you know, have a list of bad things that others do. If you have love, then you're patient. And all the things that are written down in 1 Corinthians. It is the qualities that come out of it. Love is the will to good. If you want to have a definition, here it is. Love is the will to good. It's the will to do for the good of the object that I love. When I use that thing, I love cheesecake, I don't will the good of cheesecake in that sense. You know, I want to eat it. But it will be different if love is will to good. If I love a person, then what love is, I will the good of that person. I will the best of that person. I will that. Remember, see what I say here? I will this, not I feel this. Or there could be moments when my feelings go the other way. I will it. I decide to do that. I decide to love the other person. I decide to do good to the other person. Love is the will to good. It's the freedom to serve others without any selfish motivation. You know what the best example of that kind of love was, or one of the best, is when Jesus washed the feet. An act of love. There was no benefit for him in it. There was no glory in him for it, even to the fact that Peter couldn't even understand. He couldn't even put it together. What are you doing, Jesus? Free of selfish interest. By the way, this whole, I don't want to take too long, there's so much in this text, but this one interaction with Peter is so interesting. When Peter says, you know, Jesus, what are you doing? If Jesus would have done it out of selfish motives, this would be the moment to say, oh, finally you see what I'm doing. But none of that. Jesus is not flattered by Peter. You know, he is not complimenting. He says, hey, Peter, you need much more. And so on. He answers them. So love is the will to do good. Paul also, as I said, reflected in many ways about love. He writes, for example, in 1 Timothy 1-5, when he talks about instruction, the proper instruction, proper preaching. And he says, the goal of such instruction is love. By the way, I often have to think about this even in our way of teaching and preaching. What do I want to achieve? Do I want to aggravate people? Do I want to beat people over the head? Do I want just to challenge? I mean, challenge in itself is good. But Peter says here, Paul says here, the goal of instruction, what I want to solicit from those who are listening is love. Love and response. The love that comes from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. Here's a good description again of true love. Love from a pure heart. No selfish motivation here. No manipulation. You know that I want to manipulate somebody to get what I want. Pure heart. Pure heart. Out of good conscience. Unburdened with guilt. How much love is flowing because I have a bad conscience? It starts with small kids. You know, when they've done something wrong, the first thing they do is do something good. Be very good. And we learn that pattern. You know, how we often continue this kind of pattern. We have a bad conscience. What do people think? I mean, I grew up with this kind of mantra. What do people think? Friends, let me say it once and for all. This is not a biblical motivation. It's a very bad one, in fact. Because it is a bad conscience motivation. And it's always bad. It always leads me to must and I should. And I'm imprisoned in my own imagination of what is good and what's bad. But if I can love out of a good conscience, free of self-interest, free even of what people think of me and how they perceive me and whether they think they're right. You see what self-denial, how that plays a role? In self-denial, I leave the results of my actions to God and I'm not controlling them. I'm not doing things so that people do certain things to me. I just leave. I just be good. I just love them. And let God deal with the results. And love from sincere faith. genuine confidence in God's goodness and care that he truly sees everything, and I want to do this in this kind of deepest, in the deepest sense, love is nothing that you choose to do. Love is something you want to become. That love in its deepest sense is not something that you choose to do. Love is something that you want to be. You want to become a loving person. Love then is not something that you can turn on and off. Oh, I love this person, this I don't. Love, if you're a loving person, you don't make those choices. You're just a loving person. You're filled with this kind of love. Can you imagine God to be like that? Oh, it's you. Oh, no. but you I love. See, we never assume that God acts that way because God is love. Why would we then do this if we want to live like God? So only Jesus enables us to live this kind of selfless love. It's only in real connection with him and with his power and in the relationship with him that we can live a life of selfless, joyful, anxiety-free, loving service on others. So let me close with a couple of thoughts. How do we start? It needs to become practical. It needs to become practical. At first, I would say, don't love everybody. See, and one of the biggest failures in Christianity is often this idea of you need to love everybody. Let me tell you, maybe you haven't noticed it yet, but you can't. God can. Thank you. I can't. I have limitations. I am just this much, and that's all I can do. So don't love and get stuck with this. Love everybody. By the way, this is also the idea behind that guy that came to Jesus when he talked. He says, so who is my neighbor? I cannot potentially love everyone. And Jesus said, yeah, you're right. But because the question you have to ask is, who can I a neighbor to? Who can I be a neighbor to? Who would be the one who is on the road when I'm traveling that needs help? That's your neighbor. So don't just get stuck with this excuse of love everybody and you're totally overwhelmed. But love somebody. Love somebody. Spread your love and show love to someone. By the way, the word neighbor is an interesting word where it comes from. It's an old English word. Comes from boer, which is a farmer who lives nigh, you know, neighbor, a farmer who lives close, and that's the word in English. It's not the same word in Greek, by the way, but it's a word in English, you know, that's used for love your neighbor, love the farmer who lives close to you, be good to them. It's an interesting concept. Be good to the people that live close to you. That's the idea. Be good to the people that are your neighbors, literally. Be good to them. Love them. Start loving them. And I think here is where I would just say the experiment should start. Love your neighbor. Start loving them. And be very specific and not just, oh, I love all my neighbors. I love everybody in the world. And you might not manage to love just one. Love somebody. Identify that one. And I would even suggest if you really started with this experiment, don't start with the most difficult one. Start with the people that you may walk with, that you work with, that you live with. It might even be your own. Well, that's a good idea. But love somebody. So pick somebody. You know, who it is? Who is this? Don't start with hard cases. Start loving a person, with somebody that you want to shower with your love. When? Now. Good time. Or for a limited time. Let me suggest that. Then I say, okay, for the next week, I want to love that neighbor, whoever that is in your case. It's an experiment. So just go and do it. How? Start praying for that person. Start very deliberately praying for the thanking for that person, for the fact that God created that person, that this person is immensely valuable in the sight of God, that he sent his son Jesus Christ to die for that person. And then set your sight on that person. Just observe that person. Don't be creepy, you know, but observe this person. And look for what God may be doing in the life of that person, where you could help, where you just can show love. And let's understand one thing. Love is not always what I think it is. Sometimes we do some things for other people because we think it's the greatest thing to do, but it might be the wrong thing at the wrong time. And then we're so deflated and disappointed. To love somebody takes a lot of attention, a lot of what a person really needs. And in that response to loving someone, to be very realistic. Very realistic. See, if your neighbor, as you pray for their neighbor, if you think about that, and he somehow in your conversation comes up that his toilet is not working, and you have no idea how to fix it, don't go and fix it. That's not love. It has to be appropriate to your gifts. You may know somebody who's able to fix it, and you might help that person to find that. That person might be in dire straits financially, and you might just say, hey, I'll pay for that. I'll get the plumber out. That might be the loving person. So it has to be appropriate to your gifts, they're appropriate to your abilities. God is never bypassing that and say, oh, you have to become wacko and weird now. No. You just be real where you are, and you have open eyes to see how you can help. See, with this story with the one that walks down from Jericho to Jerusalem, and he sees this guy laying there, he just stops and helps. That's something to do. It's not that we sometimes even plan those things. Just love is real. Pray for the person. Observe the person. See how the need can be met. And after a week, it's fun. It is good to help another person. It is good. It is rewarding. Your heart will be filled with joy as you start helping others and can offer them help that is needed. And it brings joy to your life. Yes, sometimes sacrifice. Yep. And let me close with two remarks. Love could also mean to say. See, love is not showering somebody indiscriminately with goodness. That's not love. That's smothering somebody. Love is, as I said before, observing, being very observant, praying a lot about that, seeing what the needs are. I mean, if you're married for long enough, you know how that works, don't you? You know, you find out how your, at least I hope so, over time, how your spouse reacts and what is the language of love that your spouse has at that point of time. You know, because it's not what I think sometimes is great. And sometimes total opposite. If I look at my wife and me, we're so opposite in many ways. One simple thing, she loves cards. But it's what you learn. So if she would shower me with cards, I would appreciate that, you know. Or if I would give her toys, you know, stuff that I like and give it to her, then I might not really understand where she is. See, we have to learn that, and you have to learn it with your neighbors. And love can seem to say no. Love can also mean to say no because you are not here to please people. Sometimes love can look like that. You know, oh, what you need? I will do whatever you need. That's not our job. To just be at the whim of somebody, that's slavery. If you have the whim of somebody and fulfill all this, and those needs can be very selfish, they can be actually sinful. And you have to say very lovingly, no, nope, I won't do that. Have you ever been in those situations when in the office and somebody said, hey, can you tell the boss, you know, that I was here on time, although he was three hours late? No. And that has nothing to do with not loving. It's just, I'm not cooperating with evil. I'm not cooperating with sinful stuff. I'm not doing this. And by the time you do this more often, they will out. So love simply was the best. Love wants the truth, and whatever serves is good. And lastly, love could mean to forgive. You see, the person with the most power over you is the one you cannot forgive. The most power over you, because that person is on you. Forgiving is not an emotional action. It is a willing action where I say, I will not act. I will not retaliate. I will not lash out. I will not pay back. I often say, and that's right, God is important here, and very important actually, because I often say it when we have premarital counseling and talk about fights, and I know when you're premarital counseling, they never had fights, so they don't know what I'm talking about. But when they are later on, and when we are in this process, when we learn to forgive, that forgiveness is really this process of not wanting to react. Because there's some evil acts that are happening that cry for justice. If something pretty bad happens, they cry for justice. And forgiving seems often like this cope-out, you know, just let it happen. But as a Christian, I have the faith. See where faith comes in again? And where self-denial comes in, where myself can be quieted in the fact that God, you take care of that. A Christian can do that because I trust and I know that God will take care. He will take care of that evil. I don't have to retaliate. The Bible even says so. Don't retaliate. Let God do this. So forgiveness is just this letting things go and turning whatever evil is being committed to over to God. Love and forgiveness is not reconciliation. When I forgive, I decide not to retaliate. And I do this because I commit this person over to God. But it doesn't mean I'm reconciled by any stretch. Reconciliation has to have two. And there are situations where reconciliation may not ever happen. I think of rape victims, abuse, where reconciliation may not happen, but forgiveness can happen. That I do not retaliate, that I do not pay back, that I turn this person over. Forgiveness is also not forgetting. Forgive and forget. No, never say that. Things will be etched in your memory, some of the evil. And they're good. They can be turned to good that you remember it. But every time that becomes overpowering, you doesn't mean to forget. And lastly, forgiveness doesn't mean it stops hurting. If you forgive someone, it doesn't mean that it stops hurting. You may live with that hurt and wound that it will have. Now, let's close. Living the good life. Can you imagine that a person who habitually fills his or her mind? Can you imagine that a person who seeks God in everything he or she does, who has learned to entrust God with all desires and outcomes, can you imagine a person who, because he or she knows all her needs are taken care of, is capable of truly? Can you imagine that a truly loving person, without grudges, resentments, fully, and that can happen. The one thing that saddened me the most in these last, who are fighting against all kinds of enemies, while we have a job to do and to be busy with loving people. Be busy with bringing the good news to people around us. That's the most loving. If you're busy with that, I would say you have not much time for anything else. But it also means you need to be very inventive. Because things are not the same, as you know. But you have to find out how you can do this now. How can I reach out and love my neighbor? I do that by where I do that because I respect the health. I do this because I respect my neighbors. And I'm not interested in what my big fat self wants. See, life can still be lived during these times. Actually, a good life. A life that is full of love and brimming with goodness. Are you willing to do that?